Well, good morning. They say two is company and three is a crowd. So
what is this?
Well, it's enough for now. And of course, naturally, we can't see everyone, but the room is crowded anyway. Let's put it that way. And we have volunteered this morning to give out the declaration of ULT. And after that, we'll have a little reading for you. We have volunteered to spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. And for that purpose, we read that the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave at the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and exemplification in practice of those principles through a true realization of the self, a profound conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists wherever and however situated is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. Therefore, has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race or creed or sex, condition or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. For that purpose, we hold several meetings a week. As you can see, we began promptly at 11 a.m. this morning. The doors were open at 10:30, and the meeting will last till 12 noon today. On the weekdays, Wednesdays, we open the door early so that you can come in and visit our library. It's a study library, Theosophical Reference Library, and also at that library table and in the middle here, you'll always find volunteers to explain things to you, point out to you the declaration, and inform you about those three fundamental ideas. Now, the study class lasts from 7:30 to 8:30, and at the present, we're studying In the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. We have covered everything of importance, but make sure you pick up one of these as you leave. This one you notice is folded because you carry it in your pocket. We have a little reading to begin the meeting with today, and we would advise you to stop at the library table out front and pick up anything you see you want, but always the declaration, and yes, those three fundamental ideas, what are they? But anyway, today we're going to read from that wonderful little book, the Bhagavad Gita. I'm sure everyone's heard of it. And at this particular time, devotion through spiritual knowledge, Krishna is speaking. Who's Krishna? Both I and thou have passed through many births, O harasser of thy foes. Mine are known unto me, but thou knowest not of thine. Even though myself unborn of changeless essence in the Lord of all existence, yet in presiding over nature, which is mine, I am born but through my own mire. The mystic power of self-ideation, the eternal thought in the eternal mind. I produce myself among creatures, O son of Bharata, whenever there is a decline of virtue and an insurrection of vice and injustice in the world. And thus I incarnate from age to age for the preservation of the just, the destruction of the wicked, and the establishment of righteousness. Whoever, O Arjuna, knoweth my divine birth and actions to be even so, does not upon quitting his mortal frame enter into another, for he entereth into me. Many who were free from craving, fear, and anger filled with my spirit, who depended upon me, having been purified by the ascetic fire of knowledge, have entered into my being. In whatever way men approach me, in that way do I assist them. But whatever the path taken by mankind, that path is mine, O son of Buddha.
Friends, this morning we're going to address the meaning and symbols of Christmas. We all know that on December 25th, Christians around the world will commemorate with devotion and celebration the birth of Jesus the Christ, who they believe came into the world on that day some 2,000 years ago for the salvation of humanity. The selection of that day of the year, even the story of his birth as we have it in the Gospel of Matthew, suggests to the devoted and thoughtful mind that the meaning of Christmas may have a deeper and even more universal meaning. So for that individual who is thoughtful and needs to know and understand, there is that desire to search for the true meaning of Christmas. So we will begin with our search with looking into the significance of that day, December 25th. December 25th was not always observed by Christians as the anniversary of the birth of Jesus. It was a movable feast in the early centuries, often celebrated in April and even May. It was only in the 4th century when Cyril, the Bishop of Jerusalem, urged Pope Julius I to investigate and have the bishops come up with some final agreement as to the presumable date of the birth of Christ. Under order of the Pope, they investigated, but despite their search, they could not come up with any historical record confirming the actual date of his birth. So how did they come up with this date of December 25th? And we have no less an authority than Edward Gibbon, the author of the History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, one of the classics of English literature, to give us an idea on how they came up with that date. We read in that book that the date adopted in the 4th century by the early Christians was because it coincided with the Roman festival of Brumaha, the birth of Bacchus. Bruma is the ancient Latin word or name for the shortest day of the year, the winter solstice, which on the Julian calendar is marked as December 25th. Now, there were other practical reasons that it might be useful to have the Christians have their own celebration at that time. The so-called pagan world was celebrating in their own way. For one reason, this was still a time when Christians could be persecuted, and so they sort of needed to remain unnoticed, avoiding any great attention, avoiding persecution. And certainly the church fathers did not want them to be overly influenced or enthused by all the religious celebration and devotion going on around them. So it seemed from a astronomical point of view, a historical point of view, a practical point of view, to choose that day of the year. And since that time, it's been celebrated every December 25th. Now, Gibbon might have added that all the ancient peoples in the Northern Hemisphere celebrated the births of their sun gods on that day, and they had done it for ages before the Christian era. Bacchus of the Greeks, Adonis of the Phoenicians, Osiris and Horus of the Egyptians, Mithra of Persia, Apollo, were all born on December 25th, the time of the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year when darkness is more upon the face of the earth than ever. The sun gods were believed to be born at that time because from that day forward, onward, the light of the sun dispels more and more of darkness with each succeeding day. So, the first idea then is the date, December 25th, selected for Christmas, suggests a deeper and universal meaning related, one, to cyclic law, to astronomical events, and symbolism of the sun and the sun gods and other so-called pagan traditions. Our search, though, for the meaning and the symbols of Christmas can go even further. Now, the story of the birth of Jesus, this what we call the Nativity, is an allegory full of symbols borrowed from so-called pagan sources. And this anyone can investigate it for themselves. Now, in the book of Matthew, we have the main expression of the Nativity. And of course, some of the other books, Gospels of the New Testament give some additional features, but the main story is given in the book of Matthew. And in there, if we were trying to remember the story, certain symbols, certain aspects of the story come immediately to mind. There's the idea of the virgin birth, the divine babe, the star of Bethlehem, the three wise men bearing gifts, and how all nature and the animals seem to be aware and sense this miraculous occurrence and give celebration. So this idea, these symbols are not unique to that story we have in Matthew. The Egyptian Isis and the Roman Ceres, those goddesses were also called holy virgins. Horus, the son of Osiris and Isis, as we said, was said to be born on the day of the winter solstice. And there are images in Egypt of the virgin Isis holding her infant Horus in her arms, the same way we have early depictions or pictures of Mary holding the baby infant Jesus. The image of the newly born Horus was brought before the worshiping crowd from the sanctuary at the time of the winter solstice every year. So we find this idea of the Virgin Mary, the divine infant, the adoration and worship of the infant at that time common to other traditions. We mentioned specifically the Egyptian. Now, this whole term babe, or innocent, or newly born, we'll see has another symbolic significance. And according to the Kabbalah, the term babe or innocence or newly born referred to the initiates, those initiated into the mysteries at that time. We also read in the voice of the silence how nature responds. And the voice of the silence is from a very ancient Buddhist Tibetan origin. And it tells how all nature seems to respond to the birth, the rebirth, the appearance of the initiate. So we thought we might go back and read those specific verses of Matthew chapter 2, verse 1 to 2, and also verse 9 to 10, just to refresh our memory of certain ideas, certain symbols, and see what significance is there. And so we read in those verses, "Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and we are come to worship him. The star which they saw in the east went before them, till it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy." Now the zodiac and the astronomical and astrological events and influences of the stars were well known to the Egyptian, Indian, and certainly the Persian magi or wise men. And these wise initiates recognized each other and acknowledged the new initiate by bearing gifts, symbolic of the purification of the consciousness and nature of the initiate. It was a practice to give the gift of myrrh, that essential oil or herb or spice, which has very cleansing antibiotics properties and was put on the skin to prevent infections or treat infections. And so it was symbolic of the physical purification. And there is the second gift of frankincense mentioned in the Bible, but this was also a gift that promotes and represents emotional purity. And anybody who has had the fragrance experience of frankincense knows it has a very purifying and calming effect on the emotions. And then gold, the third gift, represents mental purity or the purification of mind. And this is actually the symbolic meaning of the alchemists in transforming lead into gold. We're referring of the transformation of the lower personal mind, full of passions and earthly desires and thoughts, into that of being a purified vessel for the divine soul, the real inner being. So aside from the astronomical phenomena of the bright star of Bethlehem, which could have been a conjunction of two planets like Venus and Jupiter, there is a deeper meaning of the star over the head of the baby Jesus, which relates and gives us a hint of the true meaning of Christmas. For example, in the voice of the silence, we have this mentioning that the star, which is thy goal, burns overhead. And in the footnote to that passage, HPB explains that this is the star of initiation, Atma, the highest principle of human consciousness, the fire that burns but scorches not. This star is referred to by the initiates as their Father in heaven. And we know that in the Lord's Prayer we have the idea of our Father who art in heaven. So this was a common expression of the initiates in referring to their divine overshadowing principle or star in that way. Coming back to the winter solstice for a moment, we want to go into that a little more detail because it gives us a clue as to the symbolic meaning of the sun gods and the sun, and while it's so important in the meaning of Christmas and why it's so many symbols related to it are found at this time. So the winter solstice is the period which the sun, entering the sign of Capricorn, has already since December 21st ceased to advance in the southern hemisphere. It has reached the Tropic of Capricorn, which is the most southerly circle of latitude on Earth, at which the sun can be directly overhead. The northern hemisphere is tilted away from the sun at this time to the maximum extent. So in the northern hemisphere, the so-called days or the shortest, the hours of darkness being the greatest. Crab-like, it begins to move back north towards the Tropic of Cancer. So for a moment, it stands still, hence solstice, as it were. With each passing day, the northern hemisphere tilts a little more towards the sun, and daylight in the northern hemisphere is longer. The sun gods were considered by all ancient peoples to be saviors of the world who brought light into the world. Thus, December 25th was chosen as the day of their birth. And it was not unusual, actually it was a common practice in ancient times to set certain festivals and holidays in correspondence with the position of the sun. And many of the architectural remains we have in America and in the East show us their great astronomical knowledge in figuring out where the sun would be at certain times of year. It was important for them to know that. But this rebirth or birth of light in the northern hemisphere is not only a physical phenomena, it is taught in theosophy and certainly was recognized by the wise men, the adepts of all ancient peoples, that at this time there is a psychic and spiritual impression at the same time. HBB tells us that there between the winter solstice, December 21st, and the vernal equinox on March 21st, where we usually celebrate the Easter time, the astral life of the earth is young. What does that refer to? Well, we understand the astral being the design of the earth, the model of the earth, that which gives its impulse in a formative way from within. The seeds lying deep in the cold earth at the time of the winter solstice are given an impulse that reactivates them into activity. And of course, in the time of the vernal equinox or the spring, we see the fruition of that impulse given at this time of year. There is also a psychic impress at this time of year, the astral life being very young at this time. And if we think of the sleeping baby, or the baby, how it's it's so peaceful when it sleeps and yet stirs a little. And nature is like that at this time of year. There's a sense of stillness and stirring in nature. And because of the human connection with nature, we sense that at this time of year, a sense of peace, a sense of gentle stirring that produces in us a sense of joy and oneness. So the stillness, the joy, the brotherliness, the calmness that can be sensed at this time of year is not because of Christmas or because of the celebration of a personage named Jesus. It's a psychic and spiritual phenomena related to this rebirth, this birth of the presence of the Son in our more and more into our lives. And it can be felt more deeply at this time of the year as part of that yearly cycle. So for ages and ages, regardless of one's traditions, beliefs, creeds, it was recognized that there was something special psychically and spiritually at this time of year. So the spiritual birth at this time of year points to the true meaning, the true universal essence of Christmas for all human beings, ancient and modern, Eastern and Western, regardless of their race, their creed, their condition. Now, we all know that the sun is the giver of life physically, but it also represents or is the manifestation of the true spiritual sun, which is the giver of life spiritually. So what is this true spiritual sun? Well, in ancient times, the sun was always symbolic of the Christos, or the divine spiritual essence in the human being and in all of nature, the absolute deific principle. So when the ancients worshiped the sun, they weren't worshiping the physical sun, but the idea of the divine principle that it represent, that divine principle being the giver, the source of all life, physical, spiritual, and psychic. The spiritual aspect of this season and the time of year were known to the sages of every civilization. Festivals and symbols were established to remind the people of their connection with nature and that they are affected by the psychic and spiritual aspects of nature. Hence the various celebrations that the Romans were aware of and the Christians were aware of in all their world that they knew of peoples at that time. The birth of the Christos, or the Christ into the world, symbolizes the divine presence in nature felt more strongly at this time of year. But it also reminds us to the great sacrifice made by great souls, human beings in whom the divine presence is known by them and most completely manifests, whether they are called saviors, messiahs, avatars, and mahatmas. And we heard in our reading this morning from the Bhagavad Gita how Krishna, speaking as a manifestation of that divine essence born through its own influence, incarnates from age to age for the preservation of the just, the establishment of righteousness. And so the Christos, the Savior, represents that principle. And last week we spoke of the Gnostics and what they meant by the Christos, or the Christ principle. And to the Gnostics, the the appearance, the birth of Christ into the world did not refer to an actual birth of a human being, but the presence of that divine principle made potent in the world. And it is, in a sense, the duty, the responsibility of the soul to identify with that divine presence in themselves and make it more a power in their lives and thereby regenerate the world physically and spiritually and in the other way. So this is the natural duty of the soul. And Christmas time reminds us of our divine essence. We can feel it more at this time of year. It's made aware to us by the symbols, by the songs, and by our own psychic nature. And it reminds us to make the effort to continue to awaken our spiritual nature and bring that highest spiritual soul within us, the Christos principle, and make it more active in our everyday lives. So this birth of Christ is not a physical phenomena taking place in the physical world, an infant, so to speak. It's an inner birth, an inner awakening that takes place in the heart, in the mind of the human being, and can be taking place in the heart of any human being. And it offers us the opportunity to raise our state of consciousness, our state of activity in a divine way to a much higher level. So there is an old document in Egypt, the so-called Book of the Dead. It's actually an English version or translation of a papyrus or the Book of Anu or Ani. We've come to call it the Book of the Dead. And in that book, there's reference to children of light. Remember the star, the divine principle. And from that papyrus, years ago, those who were involved in setting up Theosophy School for Children borrowed from that text a certain phrase, a certain chant, which they taught to the children as a reminder. And the words pretty much come from that old Egyptian papyrus. And it says, "Children of light, as ye go forth into the world, render gentle service to all that lives." And that is the real meaning and significance of Christmas for all of us. Now, we're sure you have some questions and contributions, thoughts on the meaning in of Christmas and its various symbols. Yes.
Something that happens this time of year, it seems that the imagination is sort of like stimulated, that all these things that we hear, we want to imagine, and it's really just very comforting, because it's sort of like it's hopeful of possibilities. This star, this light really resides within us.
Well, imagination is one of the is the image-making faculty. It's a faculty of the mind. It belongs to our psychic nature. And we feel and express more intensely or otherwise our psychic impressions according to the vividness of our imagination. And so at this time of year, when the psychic life, the astral life of the world is young and formative, when there is that psychic and spiritual impress felt deep within the earth, in the seeds, as well as deep within the heart and mind of the human being connected with nature, it is not surprising that our mental faculties, our psychic faculties, our imagination is picked up. Our memory as well. And that can be a double-edged sword, because memory is double-edged. It not only brings back to us pleasant images, but also unpleasant ones. So it's not surprising that at this time of year, people may be filled with very pleasant memories of their life, but also distressed and unhappy because of the unpleasant thoughts and images and memories that seem to come up out of nowhere at this time of year. And so in the midst of the joy and celebration for some people, it can be a darker time in their lives. Yes.
The biggest complaint that I hear from the commercialization of Christmas, which is supposed to be a spiritual celebration, is Santa Claus. And they feel it is a trick by the advertising world to just create more sales. And yet they're failing to realize that it is an actual expression of a spiritual soul, the Saint Niklaus. And he was an actual bishop, we think, who in Turkey, who went around sharing his bounty with all of the folks at the winter solstice.
Yes, it actually, the Santa Claus story or celebration actually began in the 1800s in New York. He was particularly celebrated known in the Netherlands as Santa Claus or Saint Nicholas. They pronounced it a different way. We think it was Sinterklaas or something like
that. No, if you say it in French,
yes.
It's Saint-Niklaus.
Saint-Niklaus, yes. So the English version of it was Santa Claus. And he would, as said, this bishop who lived in the 4th century was well known for his altruism, not only giving gifts, but he was particularly generous to those who would be considered outcasts and despised by society. He was very charitable and helpful to them as well. So that was the origin of the St. Nicholas or Santa Claus story. Of course, the giving of Christmas cards was a later development, has also led, as you're saying, to the commercialization of the holiday. But the holiday, from its very beginning, not just among the so-called pagan groups, but among the Christians as well, was a time of devotion and joyful celebration. And so our time, that joyful celebration has taken on a more commercialized approach, because that's how we joyfully express ourselves, through things, through the acquirement of things that make us happy and make others happy. So it's, in some ways, it's an overexpression of that. Of course, the unfortunate part about it is not so much the commercialization, but the loss of the true devotion and meaning of the Christmas. And it's in a time when more and more people in the West don't consider themselves religious in the sense of affiliated with a church in that sense, or identify themselves as practicing Christians, or even believe in God, per se. So more and more we see that loss of the spiritual element in some folks. Yes.
Is it just a coincidence that Christmas, Hanukkah,
and Kwanzaa, which all have the aspect of light to it, fall at this around the same time.
Well, Hanukkah is a celebration of light as well, the miracle of light. It relates to a story at the time of the destruction of the temple by the Assyrians, and how the Maccabees fought back successfully in a rebellion and found at the temple a certain amount of oil, which was only supposed to last for a few days, and it lasted for 8 days. And so it became a joyful symbol of light and rebirth and hope and the giving of gifts and sharing of hope. And of course, Kwanzaa is also a celebration of light, particularly related to the virtues that enlightened the heart and mind of the devotee. And so all these, it's not a coincidence so much, but a recognition around the world at any time, as it was in the past and it is now, that there's something special about this time of year, a lightening effect in the heart, an illuminating effect in the mind that makes it very natural to commemorate it by light or fire or shining bulbs or twinkling things, things that remind our senses of the inner light. And of course, the burning, the Yule log, for example, in the northern countries. Yes, in the back.
During the decades when we had an active theosophy school here, part of the discussion at this time of year was looking at the story of Santa Claus. And the children could very much discuss and prove and debate that Santa Claus was a magical spirit who lived in every heart of every soul. And they were very open to that concept and very able to find examples of kindness and good deeds and altruism. And that kind of soothed over some of the societal lies that have been going on.
Yes. Symbolic of a much greater idea in our nature, as all the symbols are. The Christmas tree, for example, that's also a relatively recent development. If we go back to the 1800s with the decoration of the Christmas trees, it originally started in Germany and moved to Russia and France and then to America. The whole idea of decorating the Christmas tree with lights is a new phenomenon. But even there, if we go back into ancient times, we see that the evergreen with its eternal green foliage was symbol of eternal life, undying life, the spiritual nature. And it was very sacred to the nature gods. And so in commemoration of the nature gods, the ancient peoples would bring in boughs of these of the fir, the green evergreen fir, and lay them around and decorate them in different ways. And so this also is a symbol to remind one of certain eternal truths, of the immortality of spirit, the immortality of life, the ever-presence of it, that is recognized and celebrated more at this time of year.
We think whatever your background is, the Christmas music, whether there are words to it or not, but the words are wonderful too, mm-hmm. whether it's the Messiah or the children's songs, we think that's such a part of lightening the spirit, and we think it's wonderful to remember that across the street from us, in that church, the organist composed the Christmas carol, O Little Town of Bethlehem.
Yes. Wow, that is interesting. But where comes this impulse to sing, to express in voice, in human voice, the joy we feel at this time of year? It's one thing to write the carols, but why do we want to keep singing them at this time of year? We could sing them all year round, really. But it doesn't have the same meaning or the same importance or something special. And even if we start hearing them on the radio around Halloween, they're sort of annoying at that time. But at this time of the year, regardless, there's something in them that is appealing. And it reminds us of that voice of the silence, where it's speaking of the birth of the initiate, not just the incarnation, but the rebirth of the initiate. A new savior, a new Arhan has come into the world. And it says there, all nature in joyous awe raises its voice, and it speaks of the rippling of the brooks and the trees, and all raising their voice in joyous awe at this event. So if we understand that to be expression of the impulse of the divine spirit felt more, it comes forth. And being part of nature, we too want to express that joy, that divine impulse in sound, in voice, in melody and song. And of course, that's the way we've done it. The Bhagavad Gita was originally a chant, a song. The Vedas were chanted and sung. That's how they were taught to the people and remembered by the people as songs. We saw a hand go up.
We're shown at the very beginning of our studies of theosophy that there are perfected beings, and that that is the evolutionary process, and that if we work with nature, we too can someday perfect ourselves. And so that when this time of year comes around, that joy is like released in us, because we know in our heart and our soul that yes, there is something to be happy about. There is hope.
Mm-hmm. So that's one part of it, to feel the wave of the uprise of our psychic and spiritual nature at this time of year. Now, the other part of that is to do something with it, to take advantage of it. And that, of course, will be the subject of next week's talk on New Year, New Cycle. What do we do? How do we take advantage of this rising wave that's going to last? It's going to peak at the time of the vernal equinox and not going to subside completely until the summer solstice for us. So more of that next time. Yes.
Unfortunately, many people feel that upswelling of light and joy, and they go and charge themselves into debt to give beautiful things to other people. And that is such a tragedy. It's such a waste of all that possibility.
Yes. So perhaps that's why Jesus said, build up your treasures in heaven. Yes, you can put yourself into debt by expressing your love and joy in terms of things you give to other people. But when you express your love and joy psychically and spiritually, there is no debt. There is no exhaustion. As a matter of fact, the more one gives in terms of spiritual light and help and compassionate thought and feeling, the stronger it becomes in themselves. when Jesus said, "The meek shall inherit the earth," he was referring not to those who were cowardly or thought little of themselves, but those who had made the effort to eliminate as much as possible any feelings of pride, selfishness, haughtiness, feelings that would separate themselves from others. They were meek in spirit in that regard, but in terms of their true higher nature, they were so giving that they could influence the earth. And HBB points out it's quite an interesting thing that she noticed, even at her time, how there's so much commercialization of Christmas. Even in the 1800s, she noticed that it sort of goes against that idea taught by Jesus that it's harder for the rich man to reach that kind of enlightenment than it is for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. So it gets into that contradiction. We want to give a gift to acknowledge people, fine, but the really important gift is the sharing of brotherhood, compassion, tolerance, forgiveness, all those spiritual gifts and virtues, not only mentioned in Christianity, but as we said in Kwanzaa and in other traditions around the world. Yes.
We heard recently on the news from some charitable organizations that, of course, they're thrilled to get all these donations at this time of the year, but they were also saying that it would be good if, you know, some of these things that were being given could be given throughout the whole year, not just at this time. Mm-hmm. So it was just kind of an interesting comment.
Yes, it is interesting. In terms of charitable organizations, they do perform a certain service, and just a certain risk involved with charitable organizations. This was pointed out by HPB in the Key to Theosophy, and just a few months ago we had downloaded off the internet a very interesting article in which it was telling people how to choose what to look out for, how to choose a charitable organization so that they would be assured that their contributions would be handled appropriately and distributed appropriately. Apparently there are watchdog groups that monitor these so-called charitable organizations, and there are some that are more worthy of that name than others. But HPB speaks of the spiritual and psychic benefit of the charitable act. And that is more potent when we do our charity directly from one person from ourselves to another. So yes, if we share a gift or money or help with someone directly, face to face, not through another human being, but face to face, there is not only that physical benefit, but the person giving feels the psychic and spiritual benefit, and the person receiving feels that benefit as well, and it helps them. They feel a psychic and spiritual sense of gratitude and desire to help. It's more meaningful to them when it comes directly to them from another person. And so we have the example of the San Nicholas, who, when he went around, gave of his own funds, his own means, directly to individual persons, regardless of their lowly status, who he thought needed them at that time. He just didn't go around giving it to children to make them happy, you know, and have a good time. But it was a direct gift for that person in need, and it was for that he was recognized and made a saint, because of his wisdom and understanding and the right time, the right place, the right person, the right motive, the right gift. And that's one of the qualities spoken of in the Bhagavad Gita relating to wisdom of a higher nature.
HPB told a Christmas story of a sort of wise man sent from heaven to give a reward to someone who committed a spiritual act. And he went to the finest church in New York, and all this beautiful finery and all these wonderful people, and he couldn't find anyone to award. And he came out of the church, and there was a broken down woman begging on the church steps, and all these finely dressed people pulled away and ignored her, and a drunk was coming down the street, and he said, "Here, you can have my money, you poor old thing." And he got the award.
Interesting, very interesting. Yes?
What we are talking about, there's a B.P. Wadia, a theosophist from the last century, and he has a lot of books, and he tells some old proverbs. And one of the proverbs that he said, if someone comes to your door wanting food or assistance, don't send your servant. You go, and you give it to him. Mm-hmm. And that always has stuck with us because, you know, we often want to give and help because they give a, you get a plea in writing that they need this and that. And we tell you, I'll tell a story. There's like an Indian reservation out in the West, and it's an orphanage, and you know, they put these beautiful brochures out and these Indian children. But I was very curious. I went and did research, and they're worth millions and millions of dollars. It's amazing the programs that they've developed that people just open up their wallets and send them money, and they don't need it. It was just they have found a way to make a living mm-hmm. without having to work.
Do you have another point on that? Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, just another example. There's a gentleman going around the country. He's a millionaire or a billionaire, and he just goes up to random people and gives them like $100, $200 or whatever. And all the time, every year now, you're hearing about some anonymous person going into like Walmart and whatnot and paying off the cost that people have on their layaway, on their gifts for their kids. So there are people that are doing that direct charity with people. Mm-hmm.
In preparing for this class, we were reading through legends and stories from Europe relating to the Christmas tree and how it came about that it would be decorated with all sorts of glimmering lights and twinkly things and so forth. And there was this one legend that particularly stood out, and it relates to the nativity. So at the time of the birth of Jesus, there were three trees. There was a fir tree, or pine tree. There was an olive tree and a palm tree. And at the time of Jesus' birth, the olive tree gave some fruits to the fruits of the tree, and it was very happy. And the palm tree provided the shade, the protection for the infant, and it was very happy. The pine tree, just with its needles, couldn't give anything, and it was very sad and very upset that it had nothing to give to the baby, so it began to cry, and the tears of its sadness sort of went all over its leaves. And the angels saw this, and out of their compassion, they sprinkled like stardust, which coalesced with the tears and formed some shiny substance on the limbs and the boughs of the tree. And recognizing this, the fir tree was full of pride and stood up tall, glimmering with all its shiny bows before Jesus. And so it reminds us of that story and that saying in the voice of not to wipe away the tears of compassion, that they are the seeds upon which we grow spiritually, that the suffering that we go through, the tears, brings forth compassion, which is the greatest gift we can offer, and it comes from within. And so we can be like that Christmas tree, that sort of from within itself, through its own tears and suffering, somehow manages to transform itself into such a wondrous display. So whatever we've been through in life, of joy, of suffering, it's our opportunity at this time of year to express it more definitely in helping others. So we'll stop here. We want to remind you that next week again, our Sunday talk will be on New Year, New Cycle. And this coming Wednesday in our ocean class, we will bring up the subject of the origin of mind, which, by the way, is very much connected with this time of year as well. Our meeting is adjourned.